Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title The Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of four episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this, for me, is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.
This is the New York City Police Department. You are under arrest in an unauthorized encampment.
This is what it sounded like last week when the New York City Police Department showed up on Columbia University's campus to arrest more than 100 students.
Let them go! Let them go!
While students recorded on their phones, one person after another got led away and loaded into waiting buses. These protesters had put up tents right in front of the school library, an encampment. They were asking Columbia to divest from Israel. This first effort, it lasted just a couple of days before the NYPD took folks away in zip ties. In the days since, it's become clear that if the goal of these arrests was to put a stop to pro-Palestinian campus organizing, it failed spectacularly. As of this writing, tents are back up on Columbia's main lawn, and similar encampments have popped up all around the country. At NYU, faculty locked arms to protect their students Monday night.
You have been warned by New York University to leave the area. Please leave the plaza now, or we'll be arrested for trespass.
150 people got arrested anyway. At University of Michigan, tents were set up in the Diag, a path that runs right through the center of campus. And at Cal Poly Humboldt, students have even occupied a school building.
There were mass arrests of students at NYU, mass arrests of students at Yale, mass arrests of students at Columbia, Vanderbilt also had mass arrests.
Slate's Ayman Ismail has been watching these protests grow and spread.
It's kind of reminiscent of the Black Lives Matter movement, how it just started somewhere, police tried to clamp it down, and then it just spread, and now it's everywhere.
Along with these protests have come reports of some people using anti-Semitic chants, video of protesters locking arms and pushing counter-protesters out of their space. Scrolling past these kinds of images, it's easy to conjure up a story of chaos. Ayman wanted to know if that story was accurate. So he called up a couple of students who could tell him more. Editors at a student newspaper, the Columbia Spectator.
How are you guys doing?
We're doing well. Thank you so much. It means the world to us, too.
When I asked them about what they see when they go outside, they both kind of chuckled. They thought it was so silly because to them it seemed obvious that when they go outside, they just see people chilling. You know, they said that people were chilling on the lawn is the quote that they gave me.
You have this image of students like punching each other in the street, like, you know, absolute
Chaos.
Yeah, absolute pandemonium, you know, all of this stuff. I mean, you know, the reality is that we're a community of people who live together, eat together, and go to class together every single day. There's a lot of energy, and I think people are actually excited.
Like, what a wild split screen, you know?
And I think it's really confusing for people and disorienting for people to hear, because part of the reason why we're so obsessed with this conversation is because the stakes feel so high, right? We're talking about anti-Semitism, which is an awful form of hate. One of the editors that I spoke to was themselves Jewish, and she felt like a lot of the alarmism around what's happening is a bit manufactured. And when you hear that, you have to think to yourself, like, what else am I getting wrong?
Today on the show, a report from Columbia about what the growing student protest movement means and what it doesn't. I'm Mary Harris. You're listening to What Next? Stick around.
Thank you.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Hey, listeners, whether you love true crime or comedies, celebrity interviews, news, or even motivational speakers, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue, right? And guess what? Now you can call the shots on your auto insurance. Enter the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. The Name Your Price tool puts you in charge of your auto insurance by working just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance. Then they'll show you a variety of coverages that fit within your budget, giving you options. It's easy to start a quote. You'll be able to choose the best option for you. It's fast. Now that's something you'll want to press play on. It's easy to start a quote, and you'll be able to choose the best option for you. It is just one of many ways you can save with Progressive Insurance. Quote today at progressive.com to try the Name Your Price tool for yourself and join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Pricing coverage match limited by state law. This episode is brought to you by Discover. When it comes to your finances, Discover wants you to know they are the credit card that is always there for you. With 24/7 US-based live customer service, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, that means no more waiting for, quote, normal business hours just to get a hold of someone. We are talking real service from real people whenever you need it. Get the customer service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. Ever since October 7th, there's been controversy over the war in Gaza at Columbia University. In the very first days after the attack, there were these reports that professors were praising the terrorists behind the massacre. One scholar reportedly said he was pro-Hamas. Another wrote that the sight of Palestinian resistance fighters storming Israeli checkpoints was astounding. A few weeks later, when students began organizing protests against Israel's military response, Eamon says administrators seemed keen to shut all that down.
But we should be careful not to paint an entire movement as being one thing or the other. I think it's still really important to, when we're trying to characterize a protest of students, we have to talk and hear from the students. So the students themselves will tell you that they're responding to the merciless bombing and the siege of innocent Palestinians who are on the ground in Palestine. But then the way that the administrators responded by immediately suspending those two student organizations, I think was like akin to pouring kerosene on the fire.
Yeah, the student organizations were Students for Justice in Palestine and Jewish Voice for Peace.
It didn't necessarily do anything to dissolve their solidarity for Palestine. It did more to bring more attention and paint the university administrators as opposition to their solidarity movement. And then that's, I think, where things took a turn. After this, there were the doxing trucks that came onto campus. They parked and they had these big TV screens on the sides of the trucks where they put pictures and names of students who they dubbed as anti-Semitic. And they were targeting students who signed a letter that expressed solidarity with Palestinians. And I think as far as like why, I think some of the language might have been about like resistance. And I think that might have been why that was triggered. But still, that felt like a pretty big escalation to go and plaster the faces and names of students that you might go to class with and just label them as anti-Semitic felt like a very stark thing to do.
You know, a bunch of professors wrote in support of the students who signed this letter, basically said, listen, they need to be able to do these things to learn how to operate in the world, how to talk to each other. They have to be able to express themselves. And they were concerned. And this was back in October, November. They were concerned about how the university was responding.
Yeah, it is very concerning. Yeah. And then after that, it seemed to just get worse and worse for Columbia. Each time there was a protest, more people would come out. But at the same time, at every single protest, there was a counter-protest. And naturally, when you have a protest and a counter-protest and they get close together, things heat up. One particular flashpoint made headlines around the country. It was when several students who had been to protests reported going to the hospital and were experiencing shortness of breath. Because at the protest earlier, they had been sprayed with a mystery substance.
What did the university do when that happened?
It took the university several days to even acknowledge that that was happening. And that, I think, was another turning point.
People felt abandoned.
People felt under attack is what it was. They felt like the university was taking the sides of the people who were spraying them with that substance. And when we're talking about like feeling safe on campus, which I think is a very important thing to talk about, we need to contextualize that these students were sprayed with a chemical substance and the university said nothing. And when they did say something, the statement kind of put blame on the students for protesting in the first place.
It seems like no one, like not the pro-Israeli or the pro-Palestinian protesters, feel like they're being taken seriously at Columbia. Like they both feel like they're victims of this administration.
Totally. And it feels like right off the bat, the administration felt like maybe it was possible to just put a lid on it and to just stop the protests by pushing a button. And I think it became immediately clear to them that that wasn't the case. Every time they've tried to do something, the protests just got larger and larger.
Yeah. Especially last week when the Gaza Solidarity encampment was set up right in the middle of campus, just as Columbia University's president, Manoush Shafiq, was scheduled to testify in front of Congress about anti-Semitism. The timing of the encampment, it just seemed designed to shame the university. What was the purpose, the stated purpose of the encampment? Like, what were the students there asking for?
The students had specific demands. So the encampment was organized by a new organization that sort of sprung up in place of Students for Justice for Palestine and for Jewish Voices for Peace. They announced their intentions right off the bat. They released a manifesto. I can read from it right now. The Gaza Solidarity Encampment will remain until Columbia University divests all finances, including the endowment, from corporations that profit from Israeli apartheid, genocide, and occupation in Palestine. We demand they ensure further accountability with complete transparency for all of Columbia's financial investments. That was the demand.
And my understanding is like Columbia University is very heavily invested, for instance, in Airbnb. And Airbnb is really controversial because you can go on Airbnb and you can get a place in the West Bank.
Yeah, in occupied territory that's deemed illegal under international law.
Exactly. And so what the students are asking for is, please do not be invested in this company that is funding this occupied status, which is illegal.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Part of what was interesting to me about the requests of the encampment is that the main grievance here, asking the university to divest from companies affiliated with Israel, it's not new at all. Like, students actually voted on this issue way back in 2020, and the majority of them said, we want the university to divest from investments in Israel. And so to me, that's really interesting that like this has been around for a long time and on the table, and the university hasn't really seriously considered it.
No, they haven't. And rather than just consider it, they've invited the NYPD for the first time in 50 years onto campus to remove the protesters.
What did the students you spoke to tell you about that moment when the university decided to let the NYPD on campus and begin taking down the encampment last week?
So the two students I spoke to, Melanie Klein and Colin Rodel, they're both editors at the Columbia Daily Spectator. Melanie Klein told me that people were distressed, but they weren't surprised because the police presence has been kind of steady on campus, or around campus rather, since October. And so when they got a notification, an email from the university president saying that police were going to be invited onto campus, they knew what was going to happen next. They knew that they were going to see pictures of students being arrested. They knew they were going to see students being carried out and thrown into jail, essentially. But one thing I think is really important to note is that even the police chief in the NYPD said that these protesters were peaceful, and that nobody resisted. And so you have to ask the question, like, why are these protesters constantly being painted as being a threat? I feel like the introduction of the police was perceived by Klein and Rodel as being the escalation, being the violence that was brought to campus.
We'll be right back after a quick break.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Hey, listeners, whether you love true crime or comedies, celebrity interviews, news, or even motivational speakers, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue, right? And guess what? Now you can call the shots on your auto insurance, too. Enter the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. The Name Your Price tool puts you in charge of your auto insurance by working just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance. Then they'll show you a variety of coverages that fit within your budget, giving you options. Now, that's something you'll want to press play on. It's easy to start a quote, and you'll be able to choose the best option for you fast. It's just one of the many ways you can save with Progressive Insurance. Quote today at progressive.com to try the Name Your Price tool for yourself and join over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
This podcast is sponsored by Ramp. Are you the decision maker in your company? Consider this. For the first time in decades, there's a better option for a corporate card and spend management platform. Meet Ramp, the only corporate card and spend management system designed to help you spend less money so you can make more. Most corporate credit cards offer points as incentives, but those points amount to less than their worth in real cash value. Ramp's business cards offer you cash back, real money in your pocket. Plus, you control who spends what with each vendor. And Ramp software collects and verifies receipts automatically, which means you'll stop wasteful spending and close your books in hours instead of days. Businesses that use Ramp add up to 5% to their bottom line the first year. If you're a decision maker, adding Ramp could be one of the best decisions you've ever made. And now get $250 when you join Ramp for free. Just go to ramp.com/easy. ramp.com/easy. ramp.com/easy.
Cards issued by Sutton Bank and Celtic Bank, members of FDIC. Terms and conditions apply.
I want to really dig into that interview you did with a student journalist at Columbia, because I feel like so much of the coverage I've seen over the last week has been done by and for people outside of the school. And so I'm super curious about people inside. What did the students you spoke to make of this disconnect between disagreeing factions at the university, the people who feel like they're unable to protest and express themselves as people who want justice in Gaza, and people who feel under threat because of anti-Semitism? Like, what do they make of this disconnect, and like, what's true in it?
You know, I really enjoy talking to these students. I think they see it, what's happening, more clearly than anybody else right now. Milene Klein, who was Jewish, by the way, really gave me like this really incredible quote. She was talking about how upsetting it was for her to see national media increasingly raise the alarm over and over again. And she told me about the announcement coming from the Kraft Center, the Jewish center on campus. They released a statement saying that they were going to be beefing up security for Passover. And she actually got that email while I was on the phone with her.
We just got an email?
Yeah, let me see what it is.
From who?
From Columbia.
She read the email out loud to me, and as she was reading it out loud, she was having like these reactions. She was going like,
Are you joking? Okay, I'm going to shut my mouth. Increase coverage during Passover, please.
And I asked her, I was like, why does that strike you as unserious? And she said it all felt alarmist.
I think it's ridiculous because it implies a level of danger that simply is not there. And I think that honestly is more distressing to Jewish students potentially than anything else that's actually happening on campus. Because if you hear, you know.
Because it sends off an alarm, basically. It tells you to be scared.
It sends a signal saying that if you're going to be outside and visibly Jewish or near campus, you will be attacked by a horde of people who are just blinded by their rage against Jewish people, just, you know. And she told me that that's just not the case, and that's just not the reality. And so she thought this this measure, whether it's valid or not, you know, it could be valid because there are tons of people around campus who aren't students who are organizing protests in reaction to the NYPD's show of force. That it could be conceivably rational to feel unsafe now that there are so many non-students and, you know, there's so many strangers around. And so it would make sense to have those kinds of feelings. But at the same time, this kind of message sends out to the people who are not on campus, people like you and I who are watching on our phones or on our computers, it sends us the wrong message. And that's what she was concerned about.
The students you talked to were also concerned about instigators on campus. Specifically, one professor in the business school in particular. Can you tell me about who was concerning them the most?
Yeah, we talked specifically about a professor. His name is Shai David I. He's on Twitter. He's amassed a huge following since he made himself sort of a character in all of the protest movements. He put it upon himself to show up outside of some of these protests and record students protesting and put it online with like nefarious comments and accusations. You know, he's been calling students terrorists for as long as this student movement has been around. He's equating protesting in solidarity with Palestinians who are being bombed as being blatantly pro-Hamas. And many students feel like he's putting them in danger. And last Friday, he posted a video of students just praying on campus and sort of sent like a shocking, chilling warning saying that, look at what's happening in your country, to his followers.
And they were just praying.
Muslim Americans are very familiar with that kind of language, right? I did a very thorough story on a six-year-old who was stabbed to death 26 times with a military serrated knife because of their Palestinian and Muslim identity. So we're familiar with how that kind of rhetoric leads to violence. And then Malene Klein...
The editor.
Yeah, the editor, Malene Klein, used Shai David I's behavior as an example of what the university was willing to tolerate versus what it wasn't willing to tolerate. That the university was comfortable with this professor going in and calling students terrorists. Like, that's bad, right? Versus what they weren't comfortable with allowing, which was just students occupying the lawn.
To be fair, it sounds like Shai David I, the winds may be shifting for him. He tried to get on to the main campus the other day, and it seemed like his card wasn't working. Like, the university had basically tried to prevent him from getting on campus to where the encampment is. So that is happening, but I think it's important to note this is after many months of him being incredibly vocal about his point of view and incredibly anti these student protests.
Right. And we should clarify that he wasn't like he was just going to work and then his card was denied. He had brought a mob with him of student alums who are going to be carrying Israeli flags and posters. And his plan was to go into the center of the encampment and stage a counter protest inside the student protest. And he asked for a police escort. So I think the implication is clear of what could happen if you were to bring belligerent counter protest, place it in the center of a protest on the lawn and invite police.
You know, when I was getting ready for this interview, I was reading the Columbia Spectator because I wanted to be familiar with it when we spoke. And I was really struck by this one article that ran recently that had this story in it from a Jewish student that I thought got into a lot of the problems that are happening at Columbia right now. The student talked about how he'd been harassed on campus. He'd been called an effing Jew and a Zionist, and people had jeered at him that they were happy he was leaving campus. He was leaving for Passover. He clearly felt attacked. But he was also really clear that the protests on campus weren't the problem. He said the encampment itself wasn't anti-Semitism. They're sitting there, they're sharing their thoughts, and they have a right to free speech. But that said, I am experiencing anti-Semitism on campus. I wonder if the students you spoke to think the university is responding to what's happening at Columbia with the kind of nuance that student has.
Yeah, I saw that op ed too, and I thought it was very powerful. I agree that it cuts straight to some of the tension here. But when I spoke to the editors, Malene Klein and Colin Rodel, they thought that they wished that the administration would do anything to take these protests seriously and actually communicate with their students. Colin Rodel talked to me about POC students at Columbia and how anxious and anxiety-inducing it is to have NYPD officers standing around while they're on their way to their class. You know, I think that's another thing that we have to think about is how one side thinks getting police on campus and physically putting their hands on students is safety, and what kind of implication that has on students who are uninvolved, who might just be black or brown and just wanting to go to class too. So I think there's a whole other conversation about what actual effects and impacts that there are when you're inviting NYPD officers who have a long history of racism and stop and frisk and all of that onto campus to police your students.
Yeah. Yeah, it gets to the fact that I think over the past few weeks, these protests have been framed in a kind of mutually exclusive way, that universities can either crack down on anti-Semitism or they can allow pro-Palestine protests on campus. Do the students you spoke to really think those are the only two options?
No. I think the students that I spoke to are incredibly smart. And for them, they think the university has only one choice, and it is to be more transparent and honest with their student body. Colin Rodel made a point. He said the university needs to just put out a statement saying whether or not they were going to divest. And if they weren't going to divest, let the student body know. And if you want to take them seriously, you have to talk about their stance on Palestine. I mean, let's just take a second, Mary, and I think this is actually really important, to put ourselves in the minds of some of these protests who are protesting on the lawn. Just a few days ago, there was a mass grave that was uncovered outside one of the hospitals where the IDF had been operating. They found 300 bodies. These students are looking at these pictures of bodies being pulled out of the ground with zip ties, cuffs around their ankles and cuffs around their wrists, which makes it look very strikingly to an execution. And some of these bodies are wearing scrubs, medical scrubs. They're watching clips of people chipping away at concrete blocks, trying to excavate living children who have been trapped under the rubble for sometimes days, you know, and they're not always successful. So there's a lot of videos online that these students who are protesting are watching, showing lifeless bodies of kids. And I think that's the reality on the ground for many of these students who are protesting specifically. That's what they want to be taken seriously. I think there's a reason why this movement is spreading, and it's because it's just not being taken seriously.
I think the one thing everyone can agree on is that Columbia University isn't doing a good job here at responding to what's going on campus. After speaking to these students, if President Shafiq called you up and asked for advice, what would you tell her?
I think she needs to get on the podium, get on a microphone, walk, go to the encampment herself and meet some of these students and ask them why they don't feel safe. One of the things that Malene Klein said is going to stick with me forever. When I asked her why she thinks the administration went to Congress and deployed the police instead of taking the students seriously, she said, fundamentally, it's the way that every major university in the country operates. It is beholden to donors and donor interests.
And any kind of student protest movement is fundamentally incompatible with these financial bodies and political bodies that are exerting just a really undue amount of influence.
Right. And that to me made me feel like this is not an issue of like Shafiq's choices. And as we're seeing how the protest movement spreads to all of the other campuses, there's a much larger issue here at play. And that is how important the student body is to each of these universities in the first place. It's just right now it feels like universities need some sort of reckoning where they reassess how important these students actually are and whether or not they're willing to make some own sacrifices to prioritize the students on campus. So,
Ayman Ismail, I'm always happy to have you here. Thank you for coming on the show.
Thanks.
Ayman Ismail is a staff writer at Slate. And that's our show. What Next is produced by Paige Osborne, Elena Schwartz, Rob Gunther, Madeline Ducharme, and Anna Phillips. We are led by Alicia Montgomery with a little boost from Susan Matthews. Ben Richmond is the Senior Director of Podcast Operations here at Slate. And I'm Mary Harris. Thanks for listening. Catch you back here next time.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
I'm Dahlia Lithwick, and I'm host of Amicus, Slate's podcast about the law and the U.S. Supreme Court. We are shifting into high gear, coming at you weekly with the context you need to understand the rapidly changing legal landscape. The many trials of Donald J. Trump, judicial ethics, arguments and opinions at SCOTUS, we are tackling the big legal news with clarity and insight every single week. New Amicus episodes every Saturday, wherever you listen.